Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We're going to have a lot to think about today. We're going to begin, as we always do, with the latest on health and healing, the best science from Brigham Young University, how to eat less and slow the aging process, adding years onto your life, the Mediterranean diet with virgin extra olive oil can boost the good cholesterol, from the Hospital of Medical Research Institute in Spain, and then how wormwood kills cancer cells in just 16 hours from University of Washington, and how curcumin helps to effectively ease inflammation in your bowels from Zheng Shai University in China, and much more. And then we're going to take a look at a commentary that I've written that will help to put in perspective the frustrations many of you have about this current regime and what is the likely outcome. And I'm combining some of the thoughts of Professor Henry Giroux on rethinking Orwell and 1984, as well as Huxley's Brave New World, but putting it into a contemporary Trump's America. And how does that work for everyone? And I'll be using multiple examples because I believe that as angry as people are at Trump for what he is beginning to do or could do, it is utterly hypocritical that they weren't angry at Obama and Clinton for what they did do. And if you're going to be angry, and rightly so, at any injustice, then there should not be, it's unjust depending upon your party. No, if there's an injustice, it's unjust, and we should be equally condemning it. So I'll share my commentary on that. And then, if time permits, I will also talk about the scientist that I've spoken with, and knowing what's going on that has not yet been made public, how we're facing a society that will seduce people by the ease at which you can do things without looking at the cost to what it will mean when we accept their new technologies. So that'll come. Let's begin. I've mentioned many times that we overeat calories, and every single study shows that. We are the fattest population per capita in the world. Now, that's saying something when you consider India has 1.3 billion and China about the same, and yet we're fatter per population. And young people are particularly vulnerable because we're setting the stage for them to have heart disease, cancers, arthritis, and diabetes in their teens and 20s. And with the new generation using cell phones all the time and computers all the time, we're going to see a whole lot of brain cancers and immune system dysregulation now and just increasing going forward. So when it comes to something as simple as why can't we just eat less and why can't we eat healthy? Well, those are conditioned responses. We like to believe that we're getting a bargain if we're eating a lot. We want to feel not just full, but feel really stuffed. So when we walk away from a dinner or lunch or breakfast, we know our body's packed. The trouble is all those are excess calories, and those calories kill us. In a new study from Brigham and Young's university, they're looking at a multi-billion-dollar a year industry devoted to products that fight signs of aging and unfortunately pays little attention to the consequences. They're just in it to make money. Recent research published in Molecular and Cell offers a unique glimpse into how cutting calories impacts aging inside the cell. And the researchers found that when ribosomes, the cell's protein makers slow down, the aging process slows down. And the decreased speed lowers production, but gives ribosomes extra time to repair themselves. Quote from the study, "The ribosome is a very complex machine, sort of like your car, and it periodically needs maintenance to replace the parts that wear out the fastest." And this is according to the scientist there. And so you, when tires wear out, you don't throw the whole car away and buy new ones. It's cheaper to replace the tires. So what causes ribosome production to slow down in the first place? And it's calorie consumption. What we find is that when we have fewer calories in the body, we're doing a big benefit to the cells. In fact, we should restrict consumption by 35%. Now, it was back in the 1970s, as a junior scientist at the Institute of Pi Biology, I tried an experiment on 1,000 mice. And I kept rescuing these mice from downstairs, unbeknownst to the different department heads and the head of the institute, but the lab technicians work with me, and I would get them upstairs because they knew their fate downstairs. They were using chemotherapy and drugs, and they lived very short lives. But upstairs, they had beautiful music, and they had only organic foods and juices and no cages. They could run free. And there was just as humanistic as possible you could make the environment, because I just believed that animals were no different than humans in this respect. All sentient beings require freedom. And so there they were, running all over the place. But they weren't obese. And so I tried an experiment. If you give the standard rat diet, it has a certain amount of calories. But what if I gave the same amount of calories, but instead of processed grains, I gave vegetables and some starchy vegetables like sweet potatoes and yams, but other vegetables and leafy greens and fruits and fresh and raw and living. That in itself caused them to live almost 30% longer. Now, that in itself should have been a major accomplishment. But in science, you have to be able to share your information with other scientists, and they should be able to get the same outcomes replicating your protocols. And to do that, you have to get that information out. So when I finally presented my information that by giving a living foods diet instead of a processed pellets, that it allowed them to live longer, they didn't believe it. So I had to do the whole thing all over again, which took almost 2 years. But finally, they got the idea that, yes, this does work. Then I did something else. I restricted the calories. So 1 day a week, they wouldn't eat any food, but they would have juices all day long. They lived 22% longer. So then I was working with a group of physicians in New York City, Dr. Newbold and Dr. Cox, on fasting. They were interested to see what would happen to metabolic rates, and I was interested in overall energy. And so I worked with them, and I created a protocol that 1 day a week the people would have no solid food, but they would have nutrients in liquid form that day, and a full spectrum of nutrients from fruits and vegetables and sprouts. And they found that the people began to overcome pain in their joints, swelling in their hands, edema, and weight loss. And they were losing water weight that they had accumulated, swelling. So that showed that it worked on humans as well as mice. So the whole idea is we have to reduce our calories. When we reduce our calories, we give our ribosomes, we give our cells, we give the telomeres a chance to live longer, slowing down the aging process. So just remember, every time you have something that's very dense in calories, you're actually speeding up the aging process and the inflammatory process. So just what are the high-calorie food? Well, like French fries, a meat, any form of meat, all of these concentrated sugars. These are all very high in calories. Next up, we can look at the Mediterranean diet. In a study that was done at the Hospital del Mar Medical Research Institute in Spain, they took a look at the extra virgin olive oil in the diet, and they published in the peer-reviewed journal Circulation that it made an enormous difference as a cardio, that's your heart, protective benefit, because it raised the good HDL, high-density lipoproteins, and it lowered the bad LDL, the low-density lipoproteins, so it was good on both levels. So that's just from extra virgin olive oil, or of course, eating olives would also be good as well. There's very strong antioxidant protection, and remember, the more antioxidants you have in your body, and every time you have a glass of apple juice, orange juice, tomato juice, any kind of green juice, you're flooding the body with antioxidants. And the antioxidants course through your blood about every 6.5 minutes, goes through your body. And any free radical that it can connect with, and in effect, you're attaching an antioxidant like vitamin C to a free radical, and it neutralizes the free radical. So the more antioxidants you take in, especially vitamin C, quercetin, the more free radicals you're neutralizing. The more free radicals you neutralize, the less inflammation. The less inflammation, the less disease. Cancer, heart disease, diabetes, arthritis, all those are pro-inflammatory. So the anti-inflammatory are the antioxidants. And there's your olives and olive oil and salads. And from the University of Washington, a new study on wormwood, W-O-R-M, W-O-O-D. It kills cancer cells in 16 hours. And we've seen for so long in our war on cancer, between 550 to 600,000 people die every year. The vast majority of these are preventable. If only people didn't eat the foods that are pro-inflammatory that cause the cancer, or the environmental chemicals that also do it, or the radiation or electromagnetic pulses that do it. Well, here's a simple herb. One single herb by itself, it was shown, killed breast cancer cells, 98% of all the cancer cells in this study in 16 hours. This was published in Life Sciences. Quote, alone the herb caused a 28% reduction in breast cancer cells, but partnered with iron, the duo almost completely eliminated cancer. What may be even more interesting, normal cells were not negatively affected in this experiment of the treatment. The issue with mainstream cancer treatment is that it attacks all cells, which are essential for life. In hopes of destroying certain mutated cells, all the body is blasted with radiation. Unfortunately, this method is not counteracting the cause of the sick body, but only inhibiting its regenerative properties even more. Simply put, an acidic system with a stagnant lymphatic system from a poor diet and lifestyle choices is the best environment for cancer to thrive. By consuming a predominantly plant-based live food and unprocessed diet, it's easy to alkalize and flood the body with vital nutrients needed for healing. So this is an old Chinese herb, and it's been used there for a long time. Now there's good research on that. And finally, curcumin, cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N, helps to effectively ease inflammation in the bowel. This is from Jingxi University in China and published in Frontiers in Pharmacology. Curcumin is the active ingredient in turmeric. Turmeric is the active ingredient in curry. And it can help suppress the activation of what is called dendritic cells, which play a pivotal role in the progression of inflammatory bowel disease. Now, academics at the university assessed if curcumin could represent a viable treatment for alternative or adjunctive therapy in the management of chronic inflammatory bowel disease. And they found that, yes, it could. In fact, in addition, curcumin was found to regulate a whole lot of molecules, which are specific markers for that particular condition. So take your curcumin if you have irritable bowel syndrome. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. A special Valentine's Day to all the people living in the United States, throughout the world. We welcome you to this program. My commentary hour tonight at 7 p.m. on the Progressive Commentary Hour will be a look at love. It's a Valentine's Day look at the state of love in the world and in American culture in particular. How is the lack of love contributing to our culture of fear, resentment, and hate? Intolerance and bigotry, racism and social divisions? And how does our culture and the climate of that culture politicize relationships and stifle social empathy and kindness and compassion? I'll be sharing my thoughts, and I'll have on Dr. Beattie Cohan, a psychotherapist of 35 years, on talking about this as well. So you won't want to miss that. Go to prn.fm. You can listen to it live over the internet. Let me give you some phone numbers. You want to listen live at 7 o'clock tonight over any listening device, portable listening device. You can call 701-801-3662, 701-801-3662. I've given you different numbers, and that's simply because so many people are listening now over the telephone to this program live or to the archives, that the bandwidth wasn't enough to cover everything, so we just had to keep adding lines. So if one's busy, then at least another one you'll be able to do. Now, many of you have told me your disappointments in what you see happening in our political climate today. I agree. But I believe that we should take a measured step back and examine this honestly and emotionally. Look at something like the Buddha. Detach from the outcome, take a step back, and make your judgments based upon what you see. Otherwise, you're going to already have your judgments to react to, and you won't hear or see or understand the full picture ahead of us. I've made it clear for some time now that I believe that our current president, as well as President Bush, were unable to comprehend or understand much of human nature, and therefore to be empathetic with it and to relate to it from a humanistic point of view because of their own stunted emotions. I believe both stopped developing at a spiritual or emotional level at about age 13 or 14. So when you see them acting out, Bush then, or now you see Trump acting out, try to understand that you're not seeing a fully reasoned, fully mature adult, nor will he ever be that. You're seeing someone who was able to come as a trust baby. He was given $200 million by his father. He managed to bankrupt multiple companies, his airline, his casinos, his university, and all these other things. And yeah, he's a person who's had the ability to succeed in the business world. He succeeded, even though others have not, who've partnered with him. And when you're a success in any area of our society, when you're a celebrity, when you are powerful, when you've been accepted as someone to be reckoned with, unless you're an extraordinarily mature person that will use that celebrity and power to the good of other people, because you don't need it for yourself, you've already achieved something, then what can you give back? then it's all going to be used much like a narcissist uses it. The constant need to remind people of their success, the constant need to prim in front of the public like a strutting peacock, the more a person talks about themselves, more or less, the more insecure they are. So you're really looking at extraordinarily insecure people. And then if they want other very successful people, instead of questioning and looking carefully and with scholarship, how did these people get rich? How did they become powerful? Were other people hurt? Was the environment hurt? What was sacrificed? And if they can find people who are successful in a good way, where the world is a better place because of their success, then if you want that person's counsel, that's good. But virtually everyone that anyone has had in power since Dwight Eisenhower has profited of other people's losses. We should not confuse the likability of a person, the smoothness of their charm, their elegance, their easy smile, their self-deprecating humor, for the consequences of their actions. And we've done exactly that. But I want to put this in the context of George Orwell, because I believe that we are now living 1984. And I want to share some thoughts of the great Professor Henry Giroux as well in this. And I'm going to intersect my commentary with some audio clips that will reinforce what I'm saying to make it even a clearer, higher pixeled picture, one that you cannot look away from. You're seeing it unaltered, non-Photoshopped. You're seeing the truth. And that's something right now that the American media, including alternative media, does not want to have. They don't want to see the clear, honest truth. Politicians do not want to see the clear, honest truth. People are terrified of this. In George Orwell's nightmarish vision of a totalitarian society, it was first made visible in his great novel, 1984. I hope if you've not read it, that you read it now. Orwell's dystopian world provided a prescient and stunningly prophetic image of the totalitarian machinery of the surveillance state, brought to life in 2013 by Edward Snowden's exposure of the massive spying conducted by the National Security Agency. Now think of this for a moment. Until Snowden, anyone who suggested that the government was spying on us and using this material against us and sharing this with commercial interest, you'd be considered a conspiracy theorist. You would be considered someone to exclude from any reasonable and rational conversation because you were so far in the fringes. But Snowden showed that every single person in America was spied upon 24/7. They were monitoring you in your car. Wherever you drove, they had a satellite because that's how the cars work today. The guidance system told the government where you were at. They were listening in on your listening devices. Your cell phone could be turned on by the government, the spy agencies. Your television at home has a tiny little hole in the middle of the top of the frame where it's watching you, and it's also recording everything you say. Look at the contract. It's actually in the contract. Every single email, every single thing we did electronically, they were aware of. Every bank transaction, every phone call. It was not just recording who we called. It was the actual content of the conversation. Then they had psychologists analyze this so that they could frame a psychological profile based upon what they were seeing. That is 1984. And Orwell illustrated his point by providing examples of language that undermine the critical formative cultural necessary to any democracy. His most recognized examples, language designed to eliminate, would be thought crimes, including his Ministry of Truth, slogans such as war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. Well, unfortunately, the discourse of remodeling and manipulating and distortion has gained enormous traction at the present time in American society. And this is a discourse that reinforces a future in which totalitarianism thrives and democracy dies. It is the discourse of a dystopian society marked by a deep-seated anti-intellectualism intensified by the incessant undermining and collapse of civic literacy and civic culture. It's also the language of expiation, one that targets memory and dissent and history while appealing to a notion of common sense in which facts are regarded with disdain. Words are reduced to slogans, and science is confused with pseudoscience. What do I mean? Let me be specific. There are at least 10 individuals that I personally know, all medical doctors. I'm the PhD. They're the medical doctors. We've all individually spent about 15,000 hours researching the scientific literature on just the subject of vaccines. Our cumulative experience dwarfs anyone in science in America. No one in the media can touch what we've done in our scholarship. And yet when I've published 42 papers, including with our scholars and residents, such as Richard Gale, and we have footnoted every single statement, including the last one just this last week on the autism vaccine connection, where we show the connections and prove them. That is real science. That is science where you've gotten your facts, you put it forward, and you offer people an opportunity to debate it. Yet the entire, 100% of the entire medical industrial community, that includes all of our governmental agencies, the FDA, the CDC, the National Institutes of Health, all of the major medical publications, the Journal of American Medical Association, New England Journal of Medicine, The Lancet, the British Medical Journal, all the major scientific organizations in the United States all agree with pseudoscience. That's all they practice, is pseudoscience on that topic. We reward people for pseudoscience and failure. We reward them for their efforts, but that's the science of manipulating us. A war on cancer, we're the only ones who can fight it. Give us hundreds of billions of dollars, we will fight it. Okay, you've had it for 45 years. Have you won your war? No, but don't question us. You're not a scientist. Well, sorry, I am a scientist. And I'm saying you have failed, but you've at the same time succeeded. You're brilliant. You've gotten people to believe the lie that American science is legitimate. And I can show you on the subject of diet, it's failed. It's complicit in people's, millions of people's deaths, hundreds of millions of people over the decades. Is complicit in the war on cancer, the war on poverty. You're complicit in creating poverty instead of eliminating it. You're complicit in the war on terror, creating terror. Virtually every terrorist organization today, you created. Now you want money from us to go fight it. But what the money we need to recreate an industrial base in America, recreate our standard of living in America, you say you don't have money for that. The act of erasure, anything we do not want to know about, we will erase from our history. When was the last time you heard about Gandhi's input into how we could solve some of our relationship and societal problems and conflicts? We don't. We use the mindset of those in power, where everything is a threat and hence everything must be fought. And it is. The trouble is we never like the outcome. Orwell's point about duplicitous language was that all governments lie and all bureaucracies lie and that we accept their lies. Of course, the corrosive plague of rhetorical manipulation captured in Orwellian language is not distinct to Trump. He's a pathological liar. Everyone around him is our pathological liars. All members of Congress are pathological liars. The media are pathological liars. So exactly where are we supposed to find the truth about anything if in the larger context of trying to understand what is right and what is wrong, everyone has an interest in the game? Then we never know the truth of anything. The fact is that draconian use of lies and propaganda and misinformation and falsification has a long legacy in the United States, especially as it was used under the president of George Bush. For example, under the Bush-Cheney administration, doublethink and doublespeak became normalized as state-sponsored torture was shamelessly renamed as enhanced interrogation. Sounds nice, doesn't it? Enhanced interrogation. We have dinner together and I give you some champagne and your favorite meal, and that's enhancing. And then you tell me what I need to know. And here's some silk sheets for your bed. No, that's not enhanced interrogation. While laws that violated every civil liberty implied the opposite with names such as the Patriot Act. There was nothing patriot about the Patriot Act and the National Authorization Defense Act. So there again, look at all these patriot groups and look at all these nationalist groups and look at Sean Hannity and all of the people at Fox. They wrap themselves in the flag. Well, if you're going to wrap yourself in the flag, why don't you take an honest, deconstructive look at the Patriot Act and the National Authorization Defense Act? Why do you support them? Barbaric state practices such as sending prisoners to countries where there are no limits on torture were wrapped in innocent-sounding deceits such as rendition. Rendition. We're sending to a place, hey, look at North Africa, look at the pyramids of Egypt. We're sending you on a wonderful rendition trip there. You won't be looking at the pyramids, you won't be sailing down the Nile, unless this is a corpse, but there we can render you. Rather than being censored, disseminating views and damaging reports were redacted. And educational policies that impose pedagogical repression, boredom, harsh discipline, were bundled together under the utterly inappropriate name policy, No Child Left Behind. Well, you just finished creating an entire generation of functional illiterates because our kids today are close to being imbeciles. You have a floating standard. I'm a 35-year teacher. I teach in colleges. And I can tell you, I've never seen kids coming into colleges who is ill-prepared to understand critical thinking as today. And yet they're just wonderful, perfect little angels. Oh, my goodness. They don't even have to walk. They float. They're just, ooh, ooh. Yeah, ooh. Whoa. We created this. This is part of this doublethink. And there was No Child Left Behind. But let's make sure our children in No Left Behind make sure that they don't suffer from any depression that could affect them later in life or affect the kids around them. So let's make sure that they're tested. And let's make sure that if they have anything that we can define as a mental disorder, that we then drug them for their own good, of course, and society's good. Yeah. And 90% of all the children that were going to school who had been drugged then came back and killed their students. And we didn't blame the drugging, nor the false diagnosis of diseases that do not exist. No, it was guns. Uh-huh. Well, look what we bundled together, because such language not only cheapened public discourse and eroded civic literature and culture, it also contributed to a culture in which institutions that were meant to limit human suffering and misfortune and protect the public from the excesses of the market and state violence have been either weakened or altogether abolished. The remains of such language finds Orwellian apogee in the Trump endless proliferation of lies, such as the claim that China is responsible for climate change or that former President Obama was not born in the United States, in moments that speak to an alarming flight from moral and social responsibility, Trump has adopted terms strongly affiliated with the legacy of anti-Semitism and Nazi ideology. And for anyone who chooses to look at what it is, just look at what it is without first either defending it or trying to understand it more than what it is. It is the rantings of a person who has no control over their own mindset. But where we're a nation that is now outraged by Donald Trump, and rightly so, and his appointees to cabinet positions as we should be, where was our rage against the last president, the man who is as smooth as an eel going through Vaseline? That's how slick he was. Obama, he promised, quote, I'm going to get us out of Afghanistan and train Afghan force to replace us. He gave us. We're still in Afghanistan struggling against the Taliban, which we created. And although Afghan forces have increased it over 1,000%, he promised a new START treaty to reduce nuclear weapons. He gave us $1 trillion plus for new improved nuclear arms race. New and improved. Doesn't that sound good? New and improved. New and improved. Now, these are weapons of mass destruction. And behind this new and improved $1 trillion contract are hundreds of corporations who are going to be involved in making that. He promised us to close Guantanamo. It's still operating. He promised greater transparency of government ethics and information. He gave us the most secretive and least transparent administration in American history. Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder adopted all of Bush's arguments that would discard legal cases against the government and thereby expanded the definition and content of state secrets. He expanded warrantless spying. He expanded surveillance of every human being. He allowed his FBI and national defense agencies to infiltrate every peaceful environmental and human rights movement in America. Every single march, every single movement now has government representatives in them as agents provocateur. That was under Obama. He promised tougher rules on lobbyists and former federal officials, and no lobbyists would work on regulations. He gave us nothing. Every single bill, and including the worst of them, the worst, his Obamacare, was written by the insurance industry, by corporate lobbyists and lawyers. Everything that Obama did was through lobbyists. He promised us that he would preserve public financing of elections. He reneged. He promised us to reduce and restrict warrantless wiretapping. He signed the USA Freedom Act. He promised single-payer health care. He gave us Obamacare. He promised to cut family insurance premiums by $2,500. They actually increased by more than that. He promised to reform the Veterans Administration. At the last count, more veterans are taking their life every single day, every day of the year. About 22 to 24 people a day are killing themselves. Almost every one of them is on medication, and not a single thing has been done to stop either the medicating or the suicides. And there's over 1 million vets waiting to be helped. And there's almost 500,000 vets who are homeless. Not a single thing. And so there we have it. All the promises. He promises to help foreclosed homeowners. Yet he gave us the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which was a colossal failure. He promised urban renewal of our inner cities and ghetto neighborhoods. There's only been further degradation. The poor become poorer. He promised that he would challenge the Patriot Act. He did nothing of the sort, but actually got a second Patriot Act passed, and he gave us the National Defense Authorization Act. And so it goes, promise after promise, all broken. Where's the outrage? Where are the demonstrations? Where's the denunciation? Where is the challenge? If someone is wrong, they're wrong, they're wrong. It doesn't matter that they're Republican or Democrat, a previous or current president. An injustice should be challenged no matter who the person is or how smooth they seem. Now, if Trump would like to spend just a few moments listening to President Assad talk with the Belgium reporter about his sovereign country being invaded by America and Great Britain and other countries, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, and here is what he had to say. So if you, before you allow the neocons, who are all sociopaths, to tell you what you should be doing with Assad, why don't you listen to Assad?
The Belgian government is contributing in the fight against Daesh. There are six F-16s fighter planes in the fight against Daesh. Are you grateful to the Belgian government for that contribution?
Let me be frank with you. When you talk about contribution,
in the operation against ISIS. Actually, there was no operation against ISIS. It was cosmetic operation. If we want to talk about the American alliance against ISIS, it was only elusive alliance because ISIS was expanding during that operation. At the same time, that operation is illegal operation because it happened without consulting with or taking the permission of the Syrian government, which is a legitimate government, and it's a breaching of our sovereignty. Third, they didn't prevent any Syrian citizen from being killed by ISIS. So what are we grateful for? To be frank, no.
Do you think the European Union or even NATO can play a role in like rebuilding the country, like rebuilding Syria?
You cannot play that role while you are destroying Syria, because the EU is supporting the terrorists in Syria from the very beginning under different titles, humanitarians, moderate, and so on. Actually, they were supporting al-Nusra and ISIS from the very beginning. They were extremists from the very beginning. So they cannot destroy and build at the same time. First of all, they have to take a very clear position regarding the sovereignty of Syria, stopping supporting the terrorists. This is where the Syrian would, I say would, accept those countries to play a role in that regard. But in the meantime, if you ask any Syrian about the same question, he will tell you, no, we don't accept those countries supported the people who destroyed our country. We don't want them to be here. That's what I think.
Do you think Belgium can play a role in Syria?
Let me talk about the European political position in general. Many in this region believe that the Europeans don't exist politically. They only follow the master, which is the American. So the question should be about the American, and European will follow and will implement what the American wants. They don't exist as independent states, and Belgium is part of the EU.
You have just had a visit from a Belgian parliamentary delegation with Mr. De Winter and Mr. Karkacsi. Do you consider them as friends?
The most important about those visits, not to be friends with me. As a politician, you don't come to Syria to visit your friend. You come to Syria to see what's going on.
Do you see them as political allies?
No, because they're not my allies at all. They are coming here not for that reason. They are here in order to see what's going on. They are the allies of the Belgian people. They came here because the government, the Belgian government, like many European governments, are blind today. They have no relation with this country on every level, so they don't see what's going on. They cannot play any role. So now the only eyes that you have are the delegation that's coming from your country. And this is one of them. This is one of the eyes that your government could have, and you could have many other eyes and delegations coming to Syria. So they're not my allies. They're not coming here for me. They're coming here to see the situation. And I'm one of the players in the Syrian conflict. It's natural to meet with me to hear what's my point of view.
Now, keep in mind, had Russia not intervened, had Russia not gone after ISIS, destroyed the oil tankers, stopped the flow of cash, then today he and his wife would have been killed, much probably like beheaded, probably like Gaddafi, who was sodomized with a sword. And Hillary Clinton could cackle again. We saw, you know, we came, saw, and he died. And then you would have a completely failed state, and then you would have the entire country controlled by ISIS. And yet, any reasonable and responsible person would look at the fact that we've been nothing but lied to about there's interventions. Now, on the phone with me now is our scholar and resident, Richard Gale, and he's going to give you an overview of one of the biggest lies out there. And this is the Orwellian lie, where Russia's a threat, Iran's a threat, we must get NATO and other countries to go against them, we must get up there on their borders to protect America, and look what they did to the Ukraine, look what they did to the Crimea, they annexed it. So that justifies our position. Richard Gale, nice to have you with us.
Yes. Good afternoon, Gary.
Richard, explain the lies.
Well, Russia is a convenient enemy. There's been the creation and the illusion of a aggressive, world-dominating, wishing Russia to distract and confuse voters. There's a lot to fear concerning Russia. no doubt about that. But it's not what we are being told. It has nothing to do with Putin as a supposed dictator, or that Russia is holding some kind of a Russian strategy for global domination. That's been America's mission. Some of the issues I've noted for why there is this demonization of Russia, and one is it's a very independent nation. U.S., the West, the EU can't manipulate Russia as it does, as the U.S. does with the U.K. or Germany, Australia, Japan, France to a lesser degree. Second, Russia is always suspicious of foreign interference. And that history goes back because of Clinton having reneged on the agreements between Bush and Gorbachev after the collapse of the wall. Russia has kicked out Soros's Open Society. It's kicked out many foreign charitable organizations. Three, I think Russia is more immune to clandestine methods by foreign intelligence, such as CIA and MI6. Russia knows this game very well. They were expert at the game back in the Soviet days. Fourth, I think that the elites don't control Russia. And that is something else that's fearful. Yes, there are back channels that go on between Russian oligarchs and American corporations, or with Tillerman and Exxon. This goes on amongst the elite throughout the world, whether they're Russian, they're Chinese, or any other kind of a repressive country. But the Western banks, the Rothschilds, they have no level of control over the central finances of Russia, as they do, say, in France or in Germany with Deutsche Bank or the British banks or our own Federal Reserve. Fifth, we are fearful of Russia because Russia perhaps has every bit an excellent military on par, perhaps even better than the U.S. And this is not the opinion of alter media or fake news. This has been stated by some of our top U.S. military commanders. When the Pentagon tried to conduct simulated experiments for a Baltic war against Russia, we lost. That was reported in the Journal of Foreign Policy. That's the Council of Foreign Relations. Six, I think like China, Russia is a much more complex culture and language that is far more difficult for the American shadow government and the elite to wrap their minds around. It's not like French, where our politicians and leaders have taken some semesters or learned French in high school. I mean, for example, there are many cases when the Clinton State Department were consistently mistranslating Russian words. And in the Russian media, this brought just hysterics and laughter amongst the Russian diplomats. So I think there's a cultural difference that the U.S. can't wrap around. The final thing, I think, and this is where Ukraine and Crimea and all these comes up, and that's the geopolitical future. And by this, I mean the national security and the sustainability that Russia will face, the U.S. will face, the EU countries will face, all nations are going to face in the future regarding climate change, global warming, and dwindling resources. So when we compare the Russia and the U.S., for example, you have Russia that has almost twice as many million square miles, 6.6 million square miles to the U.S. compared to the U.S.'s 3.7. And yet Russia has only 145 million population and the U.S. has 320. The future, we've spoken about this, you've spoken about this many times in the radio show, on the broadcast, has been the future we're going to be looking at food wars and wars of resources. So if, when we look at how will the U.S. and Russia fare in the future, this is another great reason for why the U.S. is fearful of Russia. Russia is set to increase its cereal grain production by 25% by 2030. Ours is dwindling. Last year in 2016, Russia now became the largest wheat exporter in the world. To buffer that, the EU, the U.S. need Ukraine. Okay, Ukraine is They have about 27 million tons, and they are the breadbasket for corn and wheat for the European Union. We're dealing with cereal grains. Cereal grains are being, you know, the most important grains when we speak of these food riots happening around the world. It's usually we're dealing with the grains. Majority of the world population depends on them. Russia has five times more farmers. The farming community is an integrated community. Putin has come down and he's banned GMOs. He's promised to make Russia the organic food center of the world. Its agricultural system is far more diverse and more sustainable. Right now in East Russia, right now, there's millions of acres of land that are free. The government will give you anybody free land to farm if you wish. We have nothing like that in this country. So there's this whole food. Russia is positioned to be the food center of the world. Next, water. U.S. uses more water per capita than the rest of the world. We only have 4.5% of the world's fresh water. Russia, on the other hand, has 20%. One-fifth of the world's fresh water. So for the future, they're pretty well set up. Europe completely relies on Russian energy. Ukraine has relied 100% on the Russian gas company Gazprom. And the U.S. has been determined, and the CIA and our Pentagon has been determined to break this dependency. Pentagon has been working with Chevron to develop natural gas plants in Ukraine. Where are those fields? They are in the pro-Russian zone of the East Ukraine. So this is another reason why the U.S. is trying to wean Ukraine away, bring it into the European zone and with NATO, so that the EU is not so reliant on Russian fuel. I think what you're really looking at, and why Russia has much more at stake with Ukraine than the West. It's imagining like if Russia wanted to bring Mexico into the Warsaw Pact. It's a very similar kind of situation that we have with where Russia is trying to hold on, and whereas since 2008, NATO has wanted to bring Ukraine into its alliance, and that was 2008. That's when Obama took office. And this was one of the missions of Hillary Clinton. So I think those are some of the things that kind of set up why we are demonizing Russia so much and this relationship with Ukraine and why that it's so important. With respect to Crimea, Ukraine really has, going back in history, has no legitimate control over Crimea. In the 1780s, Crimea was annexed to the Russian Empire, and then there was, of course, the Russian Revolution. And at that time, the Crimea became an autonomous republic within Soviet Union, as did all those Eastern European Soviet nations. It was Khrushchev that later transferred Crimea to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. That's what we know of the independent Ukraine today, but it was at that time it was part of the Soviet sphere.
Richard, unfortunately, we're out of time. What he is saying is that we should not be posturing and building up a military-industrial complex to fight Russia or Japan, or China or Iran. We need real diplomacy to see what we can share in common, because we all live on the same planet, and they have far more natural resources than do we. And we shouldn't be wasting what resources we have on a finite planet on conflict. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. And just to let you know, we have been living in a dystopian 1984 world for the past 30 years. And it's getting worse. Have a nice day.